Mutter with the BBC Concert Orchestra conducted by Martin Yates. And that's it from me, Rob Cowan, on this Sunday morning. Next week, James will be back with his own custom-built sequence, and I, for one, am looking forward to it. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Miners.
On BBC One, Michael Palin continues his journey around Brazil.
Brazil is now the sixth largest economy in the world, with 80% of the population living in megacities, where industry and technology flourish. But alongside this 21st century dynamism, there are people in Brazil whose way of life has remained unchanged for thousands of years. It's in their land that I start this leg of my journey.
Brazil with Michael Palin continues this Wednesday night at 9 on BBC One and BBC One HD.
Always a joy to watch. This is Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Dame Linda Partridge is a geneticist and biologist who has made a speciality of ageing and age-related diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Her work on gene mutation and the effects of diet on ageing has garnered her many accolades and awards. As a result of your work, Linda, I think we should talk first about one of your most intimate relationships with Drosophila melanogaster.
Ah, yes, the charming laboratory fruit fly. It's a creature I've worked on for many years now because, rather surprisingly for a fly, it has many characteristics in common with us. And one of its useful characteristics is that it ages very much more quickly. It only lives for about 3 months. But many of its organ systems, many of the things that go wrong in the fly during ageing, including deterioration of the nervous system, which is a complex one, are rather similar to those in humans. So we use it as a way of rapidly finding out things that we hope are going to be relevant to people.
How did you first discover that this would be a really good candidate for study?
That whole story goes back a long way. Some colleagues of mine in the United States were working with a worm, a nematode worm, and discovered that if they mutated its genes just by feeding it a chemical mutagen, they could produce strains of worms that were long-lived. The world didn't exactly need a long-lived worm, and what we really needed to know was whether the genes that were identified in the worm had similar genes in other organisms, including mammals and humans, and whether if we mutated them, we could slow down ageing. And we found that we could in the fly. The fly has an exactly equivalent set of genes, and if we make lesions in them, we get long-lived flies, and the flies stay healthy and reasonably youthful for longer. And amazingly, similar things have turned up in mice. So it really looks as though this is a very ancient, evolutionarily conserved set of mechanisms that affect the ageing process and that are probably going on in humans. It's much harder to tell with humans because obviously you can't do experiments with the genes of humans. But what you can do is to take natural experiments where there are genetic variants in the human population just as a result of mutations over evolutionary history, and look at whether those that are close to the human equivalents of these genes that we found are important in the laboratory animals are associated with survival to late ages. So if we take centenarians, for instance, people who make it to 100, are they peculiar for these equivalent human genes of the ones in the laboratory animals? And it turns out that it's early days, but it's really looking quite promising that this whole signalling axis, as it is important in human ageing. And if we manipulate it pharmacologically with drugs, we may be able to improve human health during ageing.
Well, I'm sure that during the course of the programme, our many listeners are going to look forward to your telling them the secret of graceful ageing, or even halting.
I wish.
But perhaps one way of doing that would be to hear some music. And I think the first piece is something your mother introduced you to.
Yes, I was lucky. Both my parents were very interested in music, and I listened to it a lot at home. And I think this is almost the earliest piece I can remember listening to. It's Les Sylphides, derived from the Chopin Nocturne, but the orchestrated version which was used for this ballet. And eventually my mother actually took me to see the ballet as well, and I was completely thunderstruck by the combination of the beauty of the music and the beauty of the dance.
Thank you.
The Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Herbert von Karajan, played that nocturne from Les Sylphides, music by Chopin. Linda Partridge, did occur to me, since you deal with cells, and in a way, musicians deal with cells, so and their relationship between each other, so that there is a kind of connection in my mind between understanding how things develop and how they're related to each other.
I've often wondered about the connections between music, which I love and listen to a lot, and science. And I think that I use music mainly as an antidote to science. The kind of science I do is not particularly visual. The kind of cell biology that you talk about, with the wonderful imaging that you see sometimes, the connections between cells, the contacts between them, and the whole way that a tissue can change shape and even turn itself inside out during development. That's a wonderful bit of biology, and I can see the connection straight away. But it's not the kind of biology I do. I'm very involved with genetics, with numbers, because we're often looking at demographic issues, with biochemical kind of processes. And I spend a lot of my time having to think quite analytically, rather coldly, logically, about what might be going on and how I can force nature to give up her secrets, if you like. Although there is quite a lot of emotion in science, the moment when you find out something you weren't expecting, or that wonderful moment where you just make an odd observation and think that that shouldn't have happened, if our logical structure was correct, there's something we don't understand here. That can be extremely exciting in an emotional sense. But mainly, science is a rather analytical kind of exercise. And I think for me, a lot of the kind of music that I listen to is dealing with a different aspect of life for me.
I think that's completely understandable. But I would add that, of course, in order for musicians and composers in particular to achieve what sounds like effortless music, they actually have to have an analysis, a grasp of numbers particularly, and sort of relationships. So there is, for me, a connection.
Yes, that must be true. I remember being very struck at school in my own attempts to bring music into my own life. I learnt piano, and as part of that did quite a lot of the music theory. And I had no idea of the level of theory that lay behind even quite a simple piece, and also how very complicated it gets the deeper one gets into it. It actually greatly appealed to the mathematical side of me. I really enjoyed the theory, which was fortunate because I was not a particularly good piano player.
Now, I think we've heard something that you remember thanks to your mother, and the next piece, partially at any rate, thanks to memories of your father in the Navy and being in Glasgow, I think, at the time.
That's right. He worked on Clydeside. He was a naval officer and he was overseeing shipyard construction at that point. We moved around a lot during my childhood. And Glasgow had excellent opera, and my mother was very keen on opera. So the first one I ever saw, I think I must have been about 8 years old at the time, was Carmen, which is quite a strong production for a child of that age, which is probably why I remember it so vividly. And the first time that Carmen sang, how extraordinary it was. First of all, her character, I mean, this outrageous behaviour for a rather sheltered child, and also this extraordinary singing. And the whole opera made a very, very deep impression on me.
Jamais connu de nous, c'est une belle.
It's the most sinewy, sensuous, sexy line, isn't it?
It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
That sort of falling chromatic thing.
And her voice just is perfect for it.
L'amour est un oiseau rebelle from Act One of Bizet's Carmen. And we heard Victoria de Los Angeles as Carmen with the French National Radio Orchestra conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham. Linda, just to return to where we were talking about things that can help with ageing, and I imagine that you've written a lot and researched a lot on diet, but of course the extraordinary thing about diseases to do with the central nervous system is that very often it is the body attacking itself.
People are becoming much more interested in that as a possible general explanation for at least some of the phenomena of ageing. I mean, we tend to think of ageing as a process of things running down and not working properly. But actually, a lot of the things that go wrong during ageing are to do with overactivity of pathways. So things are staying too busy when they should be tamping down their activities. In mouse models, mice can be infected with flu and they can be vaccinated against flu, just like people. And just like people, elderly mice respond very poorly to vaccination. But if they're pre-treated with rapamycin, it actually hugely improves their response to vaccination. And that's almost certainly because the drug is improving the activity of the stem cells, paradoxically probably by reducing their prior activity. So a lot of things that go wrong may be that things are too active, and by tamping them down subtly, we can actually produce quite a broad spectrum improvement in health.
Well, from ageing, we're going to something which I must say, for both of us, for different reasons, I think is very much to do with when we were very young.
Yes, fairly young. I was extraordinarily fortunate at school, eventually because of the constant moving around with my father being in the armed forces. I actually went to boarding school. I went to a Catholic convent in Tunbridge Wells, and we had the most brilliant music there, both religious and other. And, of course, Britten is a wonderful composer, but he composed a lot for church and for children. And we sang a great deal of his music at school, and I absolutely love his music. And I find this Missa Brevis a particularly dramatic piece of his music. We used to sing it quite regularly in church. It's very tough to sing, but we did sing it, and it was always such a triumph when we got it right. It was wonderful.
Well, you sang it in a convent, and I sang it in a cathedral, Westminster Cathedral, and I remember we were all lined up at the West End with George Malcolm both directing and playing from the organ. And we could hardly see him, so we had to know it by heart. And in fact, it is this recording that I was singing on. So
it's absolutely wonderful. It really is. And of course, the organ is as dramatic as the voice. It's beautiful. wonderful.
It's brilliantly effective, isn't it? And in one sense, it's quite simple the way he gives the sopranos the first ones, and then the second sopranos the second phrase, and then the altos, and they all go down, and then he brings them together. Because he was a master of sort of dramatic timing. It's very dramatic music, almost operatic, isn't it?
It is, and the mass continues very dramatically. Mm.
Very beautiful tune in the Benedictus, if you remember.
Yes, I do.
Missa Brevis, Opus 68 by Benjamin Britten, the Kyrie, sung by the choir of Westminster Cathedral, directed by George Malcolm. I was thrilled to see that you've got the next piece, Linda Partridge. I know you've partially got it because you're very keen on John Tomlinson, since we're talking of voices. But it also seems to me a psychologically acute piece, and quite terrifying in some ways, and a fable, really.
It's certainly the most frightening opera I've ever seen, but also the most gripping and compelling. And I think it is because of the very strong psychological element to it. It's almost psychoanalytic. The whole idea of this young new wife being taken home, asking too many questions. Seemingly innocent to start with, she just wants to bring the light into this very dark background that's the stage set for the thing. And gradually the doors are opened and she learns more and more things that she really didn't want to know. And the music fits perfectly in Tomlinson's voice with the Hungarian. I think it's just the most extraordinary piece.
Which of the doors in Bartók's Bluebeard's castle are we going to open? Because they all have their own different identity, don't they?
They do, and they all produce their somewhat terrifying combination of positive and mainly negative. So we're going to have number three, which opens onto great riches.
The treasury.
The treasury.
And there's a kind of gleam and glint in the music, isn't
there? It's golden, usually, in the way that it's decorated.
But the actual sound
as well
gleams, yeah.
And number four, the beautiful garden. Phew.
It's a very high-octane piece, isn't it?
It is.
And when the light comes in that door later on, I've often seen it, I don't know whether you have probably too, where they just turn a blinding light on the audience. And there's this massive major chord with an organ as well. And it just goes through.
Yes. It's a shattering emotional experience.
We heard there a couple of doors opening. Number four, The Secret Garden, and before that, The Treasury. Music from Bartok's Bluebeard's Castle. Anne-Sophie von Otter was Judith, and John Tomlinson, Bluebeard, with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Now, Linda Partridge, if you're into the kind of psychology of operas, you couldn't have chosen a better one, although it's a more complicated mythic sort of psychology, I think, than the Bartok. But it's Wagner the Ringer, which, of course, I think you're actually, as we record this, in the middle of at the Covent Garden, aren't you?
Indeed. It was the Vorabend yesterday evening, Das Rheingold. And we have the main cycle to look forward to over the next few days.
The emotion is spread over a huge span. In a way, you have to lie back and submit to it, don't you?
Yes. To become part of it, it's almost happening in real time. Doing it over several days makes it really permeate into everyday life. It's not simply an artistic experience of an evening. I find myself with the music and the thoughts going through my head for the days between the opera. And it is just an absolutely unique experience. I think that and the music, obviously, are the extraordinary features.
And you know you're in for a long, majestic, unwinding ride right from the beginning of Das Rheingold, because you've got that pedal note which is held for hundreds of bars, and a chord is gradually built up over it. Well, you couldn't do that for a piece which was only going to last for a few more minutes. It's telling you, isn't it, that this is going to be epic?
This is going to take a while, yes. And it's a very gradual lead-in, with some of the themes starting to build up. It starts so quietly and then gradually fills out as the piece goes on. I just think it's wonderful music, and I'm so looking forward to the rest of the cycle.
Thank you. Of course, the symbolism of flowing water is very important to the piece anyway.
It is. It's an interesting experience for me because I spend most of my time in Cologne at the moment. So I'm in London coming to listen to the sound of the Rhine flowing through.
The prelude to Das Rheingold by Wagner. There we heard the Bayreuth Festival Orchestra conducted by Daniel Barenboim. It occurred to me, Linda Partridge, as we were listening to that, that in one way it's both minimalist and maximalist at the same time. But the reason I say that is not only as an analysis of the Wagner, but because it leads into Philip Glass, which we're going to hear next.
Yes, indeed. I'm very fond of this piece. I became familiar with it at home because my husband often used to put it on if we were sitting and quietly working at home. I particularly love this piano section of it, but again, I very much enjoy the minimalism.
Thank you.
it creates a tremendous, almost meditative atmosphere. And I think that may be one reason why, if one is doing academic work, it's a good thing to have on in the background.
So soothing.
Soothing, and also it creates a certain atmosphere in which one can let one's thoughts wander. And if one's trying to work something out or possibly even come up with a new idea, it's a rather good environment in which to do it.
That was the opening of the album Glassworks by Philip Glass. Linda, should we be thinking about what we eat in terms of our ageing?
I think only in a very obvious sense. The two key physical things I think that can be done to keep people healthier as they get older is maintaining a reasonable weight, which can obviously be done with diet, but also exercise. I do, as a matter of fact, think there's quite a lot that we don't yet know about what constitutes a good diet as opposed to the right amount to eat. I think there's rather little good objective evidence about what the best nutrient balance is in humans. And there's quite a lot of interesting work going on in animals at the moment, coming up with some quite surprising findings. So, for instance, the protein content of the diet is very important. If you just look at a mouse as a model, if there isn't enough protein in the diet from the mouse's point of view, it actually has an intake target. It wants to get a certain amount of protein each day, and it will overeat the other ingredients in the diet to get that protein, and so it will get fat. Whereas if you adjust the ratio, the animal will eat less and maintain a better weight. So it's very clear that at that rather basic level, the ratio of what you eat is as important as the quantity.
We're going to listen next, Linda Partridge, to music by Kvantz, which usually suggests flute music.
Indeed. I came across this because it's the 300th anniversary of the birth of Frederick the Great. And as I mentioned, I live a lot of the time in Germany at the moment, in Cologne, on the banks of the Rhine. And there have been events throughout Germany to celebrate this event. And Kvantz actually was a flute maker and flute instructor to Frederick the Great, who I gather was almost a professional standard flautist himself. And he wrote this piece for him, and we heard it performed by these performers in Cologne a few months ago and very much enjoyed it. So it's very a leitmotif, if you like, of our lives in Germany at the moment, and that's why I included it.
Thank you.
The first movement, the Allegro of the Flute Concerto in G Major by Cavance. Emmanuel Pahud was the flautist with Kammerakademie of Potsdam, directed by Trevor Pinnock. Linda, do you think that in one sense all the struggles that you're involved in are in one way self-defeating? Because if we all start living longer and longer and aging better and better, might it not be that nature will feel the necessity to curtail our procreation and that in a sense it's all a kind of question of balance, because we can't just go on populating the earth in ever greater numbers?
Well, of course, there are huge environmental changes going on in front of our eyes at the moment that may well render nugatory anything that people like me are doing. But I think we're trying to deal with another kind of crisis, really, which is the epidemic of ill health amongst the elderly. I mean, the increase in lifespan is happening anyway without the intervention of people like me. And what's happening is that this increase in life expectancy is uncovering all of the ills that come with advancing age. And I think what we want to do, if at all possible, is to compress that bad period at the end of life where people start really noticing that things aren't working quite as well as they used to, and also where the really bad ageing-related diseases are coming in, because ageing's the major risk factor for cancer, cardiovascular disease, neurodegeneration. So that's where the burden of ill health is falling, and that's what we're trying to do something about, not to make people live longer, to live better. I mean, personally, what I would like to do is to remain perfectly healthy and then die in my sleep, and I suspect that's what most people would want for themselves. And if we can find a way of achieving that, I think it would be a good thing for people.
Linda Partridge, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dame Linda Partridge was talking to Michael Barclay, and next week at the same time, there's another chance to hear the choreographer and Strictly Come Dancing judge Craig Revel Horwood revealing his musical passions to Michael. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
This is Kirsty Young from BBC Radio 4, in the gym with Kamal.
Tom Service from BBC Radio 3 with Rachel on the way to the shops.
Take BBC Radio with you, whenever and wherever you go, with BBC iPlayer Radio.
This is Joe Wiley from Radio 2, in the garden with Ian.
You can listen live or catch up on your computer, tablet or mobile, or download the brand new app. To start your BBC iPlayer radio journey, go to the Radio 3 website.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. It's 1 o'clock, just gone. And if you've recently tuned in, a very good afternoon to you from me, Jonathan Swain. In a couple of minutes, today's early music show exploring the music of Tartini, the man famous for that Devil's Trill violin sonata. First, there was a summary of the news. The former pop star Gary Glitter has been arrested by police officers investigating the sexual assault allegations surrounding Jimmy Savile. Glitter, whose real name is Paul Gadd, was driven away from his home in central London this morning. Scotland Yard says a man in his 60s is being questioned on suspicion of sexual offences, and more arrests are expected over the coming days. The chairman of the BBC Trust, Lord Paton, has expressed his determination to deal with the scandal involving Jimmy Savile once and for all. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, he said the corporation was at risk of losing the public's trust and must face up to the truth about itself. A bomb has exploded in the Catholic Church in Kaduna in northern Nigeria, killing at least 8 people and injuring many others. The region has seen a series of sectarian attacks, many of them carried out by the Islamist group Boko Haram. The United States is bracing itself for one of the biggest storms to hit the East Coast for many years. Hurricane Sandy, which has led to 60 deaths in the Caribbean, is now around 800 miles wide. 8 states, including New York and Pennsylvania, have declared a state of emergency. Britain has expressed its grave concern to the government in Burma about the sectarian violence in the western state of Rakhine. At least 20,000 people have been forced from their homes, most of them Muslims from the Rohingya community. In a statement, the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, urged the Burmese authorities to allow humanitarian aid into the region. The authorities in eastern China have said that work to expand a chemical plant will be halted after a demonstration by thousands of residents concerned about pollution. Yesterday, protesters clashed with riot police in the city of Ningbo. A search is continuing for the skipper of a yacht found beached on the Isle of Wight. The boat was discovered near Bryston yesterday with its engine still running. And the weather, a cloudy, wet and rather windy day. The rain will be heavy at times in the west, with the odd brighter spell possible in the east. Top temperatures, 7 to 10 degrees Celsius in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, 7 to 8 in Scotland. And that's the news and the weather, with the time coming up to 3 minutes past one. Which means it's time now here on Radio 3 for today's edition of the Early Music Show. It's introduced by Lucy Skeeping.
A short excerpt from one of the most extraordinary pieces in the violin repertoire, the so-called Devil's Trill Sonata, played there in a historic recording by Yehudi Menuhin. And we'll have the chance to hear more of it in a more modern recording a little later on. Its composer is Giuseppe Tartini, a violinist, composer and music theorist who's the subject of today's early music show. Perhaps it is this devilish work that's made him most famous today, but there's much more to Tartini than that. Indeed, although the overwhelming majority of his output was violin music, his innovations in style and technique, not to mention his personal philosophy when it came to the very nature of music itself, make him a figure of great importance, and not just to violinists. So who was Tartini? Well, he was born in Pirano, which is now part of Slovenia, on the Adriatic coast, in 1692, which makes him a slightly younger contemporary of that other great composer-violinist, Vivaldi. But you could say that there the resemblance ends. Unlike Vivaldi, Tartini never diversified into theatre works or large-scale church music, and he wasn't so much of a people person than a modest private individual, secretive even. He was passionately interested in not just music, but astronomy and acoustics, and even fencing, in which he apparently became quite a champion. Tartini's parents had wanted him to enter the priesthood, but at the age of 16, he travelled to Padua to study law. 2 years later, having married and then dumped his wife, Elisabetta, he fled south to Assisi, and it was here that he began to build a reputation as a violinist. His first publication in 1728 was a collection of 6 violin concertos. Here's the first movement from number 1.